bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello!
Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
And Bryce Castillo.
Hey, that's me, everybody.
Gentlemen, I bring you some breaking news from Parliament in the UK, that is.
Oh, I thought it was a new album from Parliament Funkadelic. I thought George Clinton and the P-Funk All-Stars had something very important to say.
That's the next story, Brian. Thanks for spoiling it.
The mothership has landed. This is Weird Things, by the way.
You read a thing and you're like, man, that's cool. That would be a cool idea in a story because this is a neat thing. And now it's a real thing. So maybe I don't use it in a story, or maybe I do. And then you just sit there going back and forth. If you're me, this was from a few weeks ago, but kind of lost amid all the other news was apparently, you know, people walking back and forth in Parliament, kind of ignored in the hallway. There was a little brass keyhole in just this long corridor. And finally, you know, maintenance or somebody decided to see, hey, what's on the other side of this? They opened the thing up, pulled it open, a little door, a little wee door like that, a little hobbit door. They did not find hobbits inside of there.
I swear to God, if this takes place on the 11th and a half story and somehow ends up in the mind of John Malkovich.
What they found was an entire corridor that's over 300 years old and an entire another room inside of there. The secret room inside of the
Parliament. That's never that hasn't been seen in how, like, did it show forensic evidence of having been undisturbed for 100 plus years, or was it sort of like obviously somebody knew about it, but just now their secret was out?
They do think there was, like, it looks like there may have been a light bulb that was installed in the 1950s, but they found things in there, like a bricklayer had restored part of it and wrote on the wall in pencil. This room was enclosed by Tom Porter, who was very fond of old ale.
That's amazing.
That's funny. And so I would, oh, wow. Graffiti from 1851. Jeez. I would guess, you know, when you think of secret passages in Parliament, the first thing that your mind goes to is World War II, right? But it seems like this is something that was in practice far longer than that.
Yeah, this apparently was used, like, when they would do coronations and they needed, I think, members of the Parliament needed another way to get to, like, the House of Commons to bypass all of that. And that's one of the things, too, that we kind of forget about in old culture, particularly where you had, you know, very different class levels and stuff. You would have situations where people would be together, but then you wanted to avoid the idea of having a mingle, the concept of the VIP. And that was sort of thing that would often be built into buildings where, you know, you hear about the servants' entrance and things like this. You look at things like dumb waiters and other stuff, things that we would engineer so we don't have to spend time around these other people. And sometimes that's the separate quarters, separate entrances. Or in the case like this is like a pathway that makes it easy to get from point A to point B. You know, in Washington, D.C., you know, has this sort of too, where we have like tunnels and stuff for senators to move back and forth. And that's sort of kind of the expediency of it, also because of weather. We've talked about downtown L.A. There's a system of tunnels that go from like the courthouse to some of the other buildings. And up until recently, like, you could just walk up and open up a door, walk down there and find yourself in an underground, in a basement below a street or whatever, and like criminal records and stuff just stored there in boxes.
Oh, my God. That's crazy. I know that when they redid a lot of downtown Indianapolis, that was like a huge thing that they wanted to do was as they were putting in all this new construction for a basketball arena and a football stadium and a convention center, was to connect them all through underground tunnels.
Yeah, well, that's we've talked about too is the Boring Company is doing in Las Vegas with the convention center. They just completed one leg of a tunnel just to connect one big, huge part of it to another. And yeah, you get like these different, like yeah, we're looking at video right now, the secret underground tunnels in LA, which are just showing you a lot of what was built, what was down there, and just how much of this, you know, there was, you know, there's an entire abandoned subway line in LA that runs like several miles that's sealed off at both ends.
I mean, dude, doesn't that sound like, I mean, forgive me, prime real estate to be developed into some kind of like crazy shopping experience or something?
You know, they've done that in some cities where they have sort of like the underground where they've done that. The problem can often be it's just the cost it would take to get it to code or the cost that it would take to just make it, you know,
where you would almost be better off just drilling a new tunnel. Like if what you want is an underground shopping experience, you might as well just dig your own tunnel.
Or yeah, or yeah, you know, rent a building that's on the surface. But it's, I think that has more to do with efficiency and not so much just, I mean, more to do with red tape or whatever than, because I think you're right. I think that I've seen several places that have done that, like in New York City and whatnot. There are a lot of these little kind of underground shopping facilities and stuff that were just these, where real estate was so prohibitively expensive. They're like, we'll make it work.
So as we're discussing this, full disclosure to the audio listeners, Andrew's wearing the Boring Company hat. So I may be teeing him up here, but it makes me wonder about developing real estate just straight down. Because we've talked about, you know, Hyperloop tunnels and tunnels and forms of transportation. But if that valuable real estate is valuable enough to build up with skyscrapers, have we talked a lot about the idea of just building down and down and down, you know, another 1,000 feet of reverse skyscrapers in the middle of Los Angeles?
You know, a little bit. I think that certainly gets to, prior to, you know, Elon Musk and Boring Company, a lot of other, you know, turns out these people called cave people that were really into, you know, subterranean things. But it's that, the you know, we were very good at using natural forms of that. And now when you go look at a building, when they look at like any kind of building, let's say in LA or New York, you have to dig down in there because of the cement and the blocks, whatever. But you find that now they're building like these 6-story parking garages way underground, like right here near Burbank. I mean, I was on a walk and I went and I looked at, like, I think that where Warner Brothers is building this big, huge, you know, facility. I peered through the fence and let me see if I could show you. And you get an idea of like, you know, yeah, if you're going to build something now, you just dig pretty deep. But it is ridiculously expensive. You know, we use equipment that's one scale to do it. With automation and, you know, better machines and stuff, I think that, you know, when Disney World, I think most of you know this, when they built Disney World, one of the things they looked at was in Disneyland, they had to have, you know, people running back and forth, pushing carts, moving all sorts of stuff. And they're like, we'd like a better way to, like, keep this park running. So basically they built all of their infrastructure and then they built the park over it.
Right.
And so Underground Disney World is like a real thing, you know, and it's just this big part of what goes on underneath
which, by the way, not to dip into After Things territory, funny how that works when you begin with the ending in mind, how easy it is to do insane things if you have a plan that begins at the beginning and ends at the end. In fact, it's one of the old success tropes that it's like, if you want to see how tall, if you're walking downtown and there's a new skyscraper being built, if you want to know how tall it's going to be, all you have to do is see how deep they're digging the foundation. And then that will immediately clue you in. So that tracks. But I guess as we're discussing this, man, I wonder what kind of technological advances would have to happen for you to maybe have a mine shaft that goes like straight down so far that you're below everything, deep enough that you won't disturb a single foundation, you won't disturb a single electrical conduit, gas line, or anything by just building out, you know, as I think of these icicles, these stalactites going straight down, these reverse skyscrapers.
Well, think about it this is that look at how often we discover a drug tunnel. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Which I believe just happened this past week. Another one from Tijuana to San Diego, which was also the plot of an entire season of The Weeds.
And those things aren't super deep. It's just, but once you go down to 15, 20 feet even, from the surface, you just can't even detect that it's there because it's the way of the ground.
That tees up an interesting Weird Thingsy story that I saw just a couple of days ago. Maybe it was just yesterday, but seismological equipment normally has to deal with the fact that business as usual from humanity creates a certain level of seismic background noise that makes that they have to work around. Similar to light pollution, if you're trying to study the stars, like there's going to be some amount of light pollution and you do your best to deal with it. The coronavirus and the subsequent quarantine and the subsequent dampening of economic activity has created a unique situation where seismologists are able to get higher fidelity readings than they would normally get because everybody's just taking it easy at home for a bit.
Yeah, it's one of those interesting examples to see. I'm sure that we're going to see that for a while, cloud cover or some of the haze over some cities is probably, I'd love to see what like the haze is like in LA, and curious to know. You know, we've shut down some. We don't.
You're talking
some
about the atmospheric haze, the air.
Yep, and then, you know, we don't use observatory here as much because more of the light pollution, which really hasn't changed much. But it is, yeah, it's an interesting, you know, run interesting experiment we're running.
Yeah, man, what a crazy idea, you know, that this is at least something that we could observe while everybody just decided to stay home.
LA's because of this, the LA's air quality has been the best it's been in decades. And it's one of the things that I argue for, like, one of the advantages of, let's say, of like electric cars and is that when you're, even if you're using a fossil fuel to do it, or even if you're in best case, maybe like natural gas, but if you're doing that, that takes place at a facility further away. And generally speaking, where the filters are much better and you get less of the pollutants in the atmosphere as opposed to things that are going through mufflers and stuff, right, in theory.
But in other words, like the counter argument to, I bought a Tesla, I'm being green. And then somebody snidely says, whatever, bro, where's your electricity comes from? Comes from coal. That's a coal powered car. You're a bad person. But the coal is all processed in one central facility with the stated goal of removing greenhouse gases and scrubbing and having emissions be as clean as possible.
Yeah, in theory, and the idea that those emissions are not being pushed out in your driveway. You know, the idea is that you're displacing those emissions or somewhere else. So for local things, and we've talked about before about how 100 years ago, what were the streets like? You know, and you know, you read a description of what the streets of Chicago, you know, the turn of the century, you know, 1898, you know, what was it like? Manure everywhere, your coal was being burned everywhere, the air was thick, it was sewage in the streets. It was just a thing that if we, our nostalgic view of what those things were like are nothing like they really were, and a way more dirty environment. And also the argument I make that, you know, I think we're progressing naturally towards a cleaner environment no matter what, you know, because we like to be clean when it's efficient. You know?
Right. Well, yeah, it's
I think a lot of the green tech that we have that like has grown up over the past decade are now coming to, you know, for full maturation. You know, when we talk about what battery capacity and stuff like that is, like, this is eventually just going to bring us to a place where this will be cheaper and easier. And that's, we're always as a human race biased against cheaper and easier.
You know, and I think that the idea of that trade-off, like how, and it's not an easy thing to say, like, oh, should we put all this money into this now when it could be tremendously to shifting, when it could be tremendously expensive, may actually slow down growth and prevent it later on, versus, you know, business as usual or whatever, or the idea that if you think things are improving and you look at trying to deal right now with, you know, the coronavirus, is the idea of, like, you know, there's this debate, like, oh, should we have shut down the economy to the point that we have versus let it run its course versus this or that? And you see these different faces of that argument of, like, well, the price we pay later on is way worse than what we're paying right now, or et cetera. So, you know, it's one way to kind of look at it where it's hard to sort of go, I'm 100% this, or I'm 100% that. It's like, well, you can't ignore the cost of either where we could be going with climate change or the economic cost we have policy now.
Well, I'll tell you what you can be 100% on and not have to worry about the economic cost because it's totally worth it, is if you head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings.
Hell yeah, Brian. Patreon.com/weirdthings is where you need to go if you want to support the show. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world today, but you want to know what any bit of cash that you can peel off for this program keeps us giving you the programming you need each and every week. You get a custom RSS feed. You get the After Things podcast a little bit quicker than you would otherwise. Guys, I can't spell this out any clearer. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
A cool story from the frontiers of technology, space, etc. Is, man, like, when I first heard this, I'm like, that ain't impossible. And like, I love me space. I love me space exploration and stuff. And I heard this, like, man, this is this crazy talk. But apparently the physics works, and it's something that's going to be tested. And that is on Mars 2020, which actually NASA has a new name for. This is our big mission, which we're going to be sending a much larger, an autonomous rover to Mars. Will be able to drive itself around, not wait for us to tell it what to go do. More advanced collection system samples, sampling, et cetera, which will give us way more information than we've had about the red planet than before, hopefully. And one thing they're going to have on there, and by the way, the rover, it's called Perseverance, not my choice, but the they're putting a little payload on there, a helicopter.
Wait, I thought the atmosphere was so thin that you could barely have a glider, much less a helicopter on there.
Tell it to NASA, Brian. Well, the difference would be is you got 40% gravity, right? And you got these blades, but if they spin faster, they can actually, there actually is some, there's interesting some aerodynamics where you look at like how you would get an airplane to work on Mars, which seems counterintuitive. But the idea is that if you go fast enough, and think about this too, we have aircraft that fly at 100,000 feet. Okay. Yeah. We have aircraft that fly at 100,000 feet, which is roughly, you know, the thickness of like Mars's atmosphere. So if we can make aircraft on Earth that can fly at that level, then the idea is then, you know, if you take a helicopter, because of that 40% gravity, because of that reduced, you're you get more power out of what you're doing.
Now, I feel like they're really missing out on an opportunity here because they're calling it a helicopter, which makes sense because if you say quadcopter, you're going to picture four blades out on four arms. These are three blades all one on top of each other, like a triple layer ice cream birthday cake. Feel like they're missing the chance to call it a tricopter. Tricopter is a pretty cool name, and I've never heard anything called a tricopter before.
Tricopter.
We have a quadcopter and a hexcopter. I want a tricopter.
Have you seen actually the tricopters, like in the traditional sort of like attrition, like the quadcopter layout, but the three blade versions of those.
I was wondering, like, is that inherently unstable? Is that the reason that we don't see those?
You do, but so the advantage of two of having an equal number of blades is they can counter rotate against each other, which can provide balance. But the fast ones, the racing ones, actually are tricopters. They're inherently a bit unstable, but they're actually faster. So you'll see these racing copters that are tricopters.
That's interesting because if you're racing, you're not worried about redundancy because like a quadcopter, let's say one of the three is operating at 20% efficiency, then the corresponding other side can operate at 20% efficiency. Whereas tricopter, if one breaks, you're fairly unbalanced and that's the end of it.
Yeah, there is an interesting research that came out by, I think, with some MIT researchers. And basically, on these, one part of what makes these pretty functional and what makes them work is the software. And there's like, I'm working on a project right now where one of it, you know, I've got a grad student who's rewriting software to do fun stuff with them. And you get into realizing like how much of this is what makes it work is, you know, the math to get, you know, each blade to do what it's supposed to do. You plug in a formula and say there's four motors versus three. This is the propeller size, all that, and the software takes over. But MIT came out with like basically like a kind of a machine learning version of this where you're able to give the quadcopter or the multicopter like mismatched blades and motors and really weird configurations, and it figured out how to fly.
I understand.
Oh my God.
Like logically that makes sense because there's some amount of propulsion each unit can give, some number of RPMs that offset based on the rotor size and so on. In fact, I can even imagine one where you start chopping off halves of individual blades and just it learns how to sync everything up and go up. That's extraordinary though. Like, yeah, can you imagine what Burning Man's going to look like once they get their hands on this technology? These highly bizarre, super asymmetrical flying pterodactyl beasts?
Because part of the challenge is that, like, you have to make these adjustments so quickly and not overcompensate that the thing flips. You know, the thing just falls apart. And that was what was cool, is that in real time, this, you know, this artificially intelligent software was basically adjusting and keeping the thing from flipping and having a catastrophic mistake. And that's one of the things that you do in a AI, like learning. We've talked about, like, OpenAI had, like, AI Gym and had these things where you try to teach things how to walk. And you're basically coming up with very simple algorithms to, you know, if you have knee motors and ankle motors, all this, what's the simplest way to get this thing to figure out balance and to keep moving forward? So it's a neat, you know, look at how sophisticated software can learn to solve a problem it was never presented with before.
Yeah, we're watching various 3D simulations of various bizarrely shaped objects learn to walk.
Yeah, this is a DeepMind has this, like, four-legged spider, and it's figured out how to talk. You know, we look at it like, oh, it's a thing walking. Like no, but it had to learn. we've learned the most efficient running strategy. It's called runs like a little child.
It's so crazy.
We're watching these animated figures. I love, that are just
this one's my favorite. It's got, like,
strategy,
a left hand just fist pumping the entire time as it jumps and runs.
I'm running, baby!
Very, very amusing running strategies, because this thing's trying to balance itself. And it's like, called, oh, I got these arms. I'll just pump them in the air.
It's called the yes, yes, yes!
Whoa.
Oh, no.
Wah, wah.
That's
so
amazing.
Anyhow. Yeah, take a look at, like, learning to walk, AI training itself, whatever. And it's funny because, like, it's comedic to us. We're like, ha, ha, it fell, you know. And then when they're chasing after us.
That's basically the machine version or machine learning version of like, QWOP.
QWOP.
Keyboard game where it's, like, very, very difficult to take a step, let alone run, which is, like, ostensibly the point of it. But this is, like, taking that problem that is very hard for us to do mechanically and machine learning that solution.
I saw, I believe there's, like, an iteration of the same idea of QWOP, but for speaking, like, it's speech simulator. And so you have to move lips and tongues and everything in order to form words. And there you go, Speaking Simulator 2018. That's amazing.
Very goofy-looking face trying to mouth words.
Oh, my God.
It's horrific.
Yeah. So, in the spirit of advancing things, moving forward, SpaceX has been pushing forward on the Starship, and let me know if you've heard this one. They had a mishap with their Starship prototype.
This one, I saw the headline and I clicked and I was waiting for the explosion and I didn't see an explosion. So it's like, but its heart was broken on the inside or something like that. I'm like, what?
Yeah, it was, you know, you can kind of tell which part of the press is kind of not amused by Elon Musk or is ready to, you know, make a thing when it's not a thing, you know. And so what this was is SN3, which is their prototype number 3, not to be confused with SN2, which exploded. SN3, they were doing these pressure tests. Basically right now what they're trying to do is, these rockets are very, very, very thin fuel tanks, okay? They're made of stainless steel, they're welded together, and they've got to put liquid oxygen, and they've got to put, in this case, liquid methane in there, right? And so, but they test this using nitrogen or whatever to try to pressurize as much as they can. Last time, previously on testing one of these things, is they had too much pressure, what have you, and the thing exploded. This time, there is this, we're watching this failure where they have I think there's a liquid oxygen chamber, which is above the liquid methane chamber. And what's happening is that it looks like the lower chamber may not have had full pressurization. And so the top of it has got so much weight, it's crushing. Now, what's similar to is we had a rocket called the Atlas rocket. And the Atlas rocket was fascinating because it was basically an aluminum balloon where the only way you could put that thing upright was to pressurize it. Because if it wasn't pressurized, that rocket would crumble on its own weight And if you look up Atlas rocket mishaps, whatever, you see like a rocket on the, you know, the gantry, and you just watch this thing go crumble because it lost pressure, a little thing. Now, this rocket can stand on its own, but not if you have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of tons of fuel above it and nothing below it.
Yeah, the it reminds me a lot of the old Mr. Wizard show on Nickelodeon, where I believe he had kind of a regular fuel can filled with warm air or whatever, and then he pours cold water over it, and the whole thing just implodes, just collapses in on itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So here we're looking at the Atlas Centaur AC-5 launch failure, and I think we're going to pan up in a moment. And so this was a lightweight rocket because what they did was they avoided basically having as much of a supporting structure. Because the brilliance of it was like, listen, rockets are really just big fuel tanks with little motors strapped to them. And if you could reduce the weight of the fuel tank as much as possible, then you get more power. And here was somebody realized if you always kept the lower section pressurized, that would add as a support structure.
Oh.
So we're seeing this Atlas Centaur AC-5 from 1965 begin to take off. Man, I still side recommendation, Apollo 11 is really an extraordinary documentary to watch from CNN Films.
Yeah, there's another film of this where you see the whole rocket and you watch, I think, yeah, this may be an engine out failure. There's another one where you see the whole rocket on top of it just crumble.
That's crazy.
Because it's a balloon. The Atlas was really like this. And people, when Elon was building the Starship, like, oh, is it like an Atlas? Oh, here we go. This is it. On the launch pad. And then all of a sudden, it's starting to bend over because...
Oh, it looks like the whole thing's made of tinfoil and it's just collapsing under its own weight. Wow.
Right.
Wow.
It was made of aluminum foil, basically. Like, the thickness of this thing was extremely thin.
That's crazy.
And all it took was just a little bit of a pressure leak in that lower chamber, and it just deflates like a bounce house.
Wow.
Rockets be hard.
Yeah. We should make a science out of it.
Yeah. Y'all want to jump into some picks?
Yeah. All right, I got a pick. Obviously we are in strange times. There's a lot of sacrifices that a lot of people have to make, but as we all are having to make sacrifices with our own schedule of events and things that we might have been looking forward to, some of those big massive gatherings are unable to happen. One of those this weekend was WrestleMania, which is normally an event held in a stadium with 80 to 90,000 people, sold out around the country every year. This time it happened from a warehouse in Orlando. But if you are somebody that is into entertainment, that is into live performance, that is into understanding how crowds affect things, how you get what you need to dial up, what can be dialed back, the chances that you need to take, then I found WrestleMania, if you're not a wrestling fan, don't watch the whole thing necessarily, but each night, they did two nights of it, they did one very cinematic match, literally shooting it like a movie. And those have been the ones that really got the most traction, but it's very interesting to see them try to stretch the medium as they now no longer have a key element of not only their business model, but also their presentation. You know, a crowd's a huge part of WrestleMania, and they didn't have it, so they had to make do. It was very, very interesting.
Yeah, somebody tweeted last night, in case you missed it, we're watching John Cena battle the supernatural embodiment of his own fears and anxieties of becoming a successful actor. I have no doubt that that is no exaggeration in exactly what just happened.
It was, and it was very weird and very bizarre, but in a weird way, it kind of felt a little bit like the future. Not only the fact that, obviously, who knows when the next time everyone's going to be able to pack into even, you know, they do weekly shows of two shows a week where they're packing in anywhere between 10 to 20,000 people into an arena. God knows when that's going to be legal, let alone comfortable, where people are going to want to do that. But the other side of it was like, yeah, they just went full art film, and the night one was Undertaker in this very bizarre, you know, kind of a backwoods sort of horror show. And then the second one was a little bit more lighthearted, but it had this very It sort of vibe to it, like this wrestling It, where John Cena was the victim. But it's something. It is worthwhile to check out just to see when a company like that is up against the wall, what kind of creative decisions they make.
What was the wrestling show they used to shoot in Orlando over at Universal Studios? Because when I had my offices there, I remember like on Tuesday nights or whatever, you'd just have there to be a soundstage with a bunch of wrestlers hanging around craft services table and stuff.
That is, it. I feel bad that I can't remember the name of that organization.
That is TNA.
That's right. Okay. I thought that was it. And that was such a weird thing, because I'd be walking around the office a lot or whatever. You'd see all these guys just standing there. It was like, you know, one night a week, they're all just sort of there. And it was like, they had like, I think, a token audience in there or something, but it was
they would get theme park. They would get the theme park audience.
One of my friends, when I performed at Universal Orlando, one of my friends who enjoyed the show and we'd hang out a lot, his name was Gene. He would make a habit of going to all the TNA shows, and everybody's, you know, clapping and maybe pumping their fists or whatever. But he was like, no, there should be something a little bit bigger. And so all he did was start waving a towel over his head. But he was the only dude waving a white towel over his head. And so later people began to recognize him, as they're like, towel dude, you're towel dude. And then at some point they used footage for one of the TNA video games, and that was like one of his favorite moments, was seeing himself in a video game whipping his towel around in the background. I got a pick. It's a tepid pick, by which I mean, in spirit, I love what they're going for. In execution, it's a little slow, a little soft. It's great if it's on in the background while you're doing something else, taking the bulk of your attention. It's very slow and plodding if you give it your full attention, but I think it's worthy for what they're aiming for. I'm three episodes in to the new Amazon original, is Tales from the Loop. And this is all work based on the artwork of, I forget the dude's name. He's a foreign dude. It's got Jonathan Pryce in it, who you may remember from either as the leader of the Sparrows in Game of Thrones, or as the lead in Brazil. It reminds me a lot of the golden age of science fiction short stories, where each one is fairly hit or miss. Each one is a very simple concept. It feels a little bit kind of Twilight Zone-y, but for what it is, I've enjoyed it well enough. But keep in mind, this comes from a place where I've literally consumed all of the rest of the media that exists. So now I'm glad that Tales from the Loop is there for me as well.
Is this an anthology like the Electric Dreams show that Amazon did?
Ish, although each one builds on what came before. Like, a character that is a main character in episode one will be a background character in episode two. And the other main character of episode two will be a background character in episode three, and so on.
So they're kind of connected.
They seem deep enough connected. From what I understand, there's short stories that have written. If you've ever seen this dude's original artwork, it's great. It's this wonderful blend of architecture and commercial items from who knows what era. Along with just crazy robots and decayed buildings and so on, or living buildings. As a matter of fact, in the very first episode, Kids in the Wood, and there's like a big AT-ST walking around, and they're all like, somebody's throwing a rock at it, and it's like, what are you doing? Well, if you hit its eye, it's good luck. And then there's like a vague question thrown out about, where do they come from? They're like, who knows? Who knows any of this stuff? Everything's crazy up here. It reminds me a little bit of sort of that Stephen King Dark Tower, like everything has become strange, and we know it has something to do with what they call the Loop, an institution that's underground. I think this is one of those shows that you will find agonizingly slow and painful while you're watching it, but the images will stick around with you. And the first three episodes, in terms of, you know, small short stories, I think they each stick the landing. But I don't know. I've enjoyed it.
I'm looking forward to checking it out. I was excited about it because I've loved that artwork. And it just basing a thing on a thing with no inherent plot is always like, it's why video games are problematic, but it sounds like they executed this better than you could probably have hoped for. You know, You know, it came out that it getting a lot of attention was Amazing Stories on Apple TV.
Wow, yeah. Come and gone.
So Amazing Stories, did it do well, or was it well-reviewed?
Well, fact that nobody talked about it.
Yeah. Well, and it looks like the IMDb rating is only slightly bigger on Tales from the Loop than Amazing Stories. But Tales from the Loop is decidedly adult. It's decidedly 18+. I think there's boobies and titties in every single episode.
Oh, yeah, because what I had heard of Amazing Stories was that it's good for a kids show.
Right. Whereas this is more adult, but also, man, I tell you what, like I think there are great 37-minute episodes in each hour-long episode of these, which you can decide. That's the trade-off. If what you really want is to linger on these gorgeous visuals that are meant to be evocative of the original concept art, then you kind of have to go slow. But again, if you're playing Hearthstone while you watch it. Those are delightful visuals that will sit with you, and stories that are simple enough that you don't feel like you missed anything.
One of my frustrations with Black Mirror was just that, was like, man, there was a really cool 20-minute episode in this hour, you know, and that's been, if there is a weakness, I would say, for streaming television, particularly anthology shows, you know, standalone shows, is that they always try to meet these sort of longer running times, and very often they're just so much, you don't get the benefit of making choices.
That's how I felt about the Electric Sheep show Amazon did about the Philip K. Dick short stories.
Yeah.
They all felt fine, but way too long. And I think like Black Mirror going to Netflix definitely, I think, hurt it, because it didn't have to fit within an hour-long time frame either. Like, those episodes inflated to their detriment.
We know it's a problem when you're able to do a series called Two Sentence Horror Stories and each episode's 30 minutes long.
I got a pick. I think this was a tentative pick last week, but then I ended up binging it, and I really dug it. It is Netflix's Ozark. Ozark's back.
Oh, wonderful.
It's this new season's great.
I got all the way caught up, and I have to revise my feeling. I think my initial review is what I loved about season one is that electric, oh my God, this guy's screwed feeling, and how he keeps barely staying alive, but he's screwed. Season two gets out of that, and they begin to try to establish themselves as in a place of power. Now, there certainly is danger associated with it, but season three, that whole family are power players, and it's a different story, but it's also very good. It's like, once I let go of my favorite part being the desperation, then all of a sudden I enjoyed it a lot more, and Ruth is the star of that show. She's great. Fantastic. She is a great character, and I'm just enamored by her, although I don't necessarily like where they seem to be setting her up for going into season four.
And like with a show like this getting, you know, being in its third season now, like what I appreciate about Ozark is that it keeps bringing in new characters and kind of fleshing people out. Because when you have a any sort of drama like this, there's always the danger of, we have these characters, we can't kill any of these characters, let's just put new people together. And there are a couple of connections in season three where, like, you just had these two people in the town and you needed to do something with them. But
there are some surprise connections in season three.
But beyond all of that, like, I think all the stuff with the casino works really, really well. They keep digging that hole. They keep digging that hole, and somehow it's still working. So Ozark, very good. A very good season three on Netflix.
Cool.
Well, I've got a pick. It's a shameless plug for my own book, The Girl Beneath the Sea.
Oh, look, it's adorable that you're pitching your book.
Can't wait for my buddies to recommend this book.
Look, I can't wait for that. Andrew, I'm sorry. We never had this talk.
Friends are like, man, it's promoting itself.
Sorry, Andrew, we've had this talk. I understand that we all have pet projects, but we only talk about major best-selling products on this show. It has to be something that's really killing it in the mainstream in order to make it on our lists. I mean, name one plaudit with your new book, The Girl Beneath the Sea, available at the Amazon Kindle store right now.
Well,
If you're an Amazon Prime member, it's free.
Okay.
You get the ebook for free.
That's almost as impressive as the fact that I was trying to tee you up to brag on the fact that it's still number one. Number one. Number one bestseller.
It's the number one book in the Kindle store. It's been there now for 6 days, which has been amazing. If you're a Prime member, you can get it for free, which is really cool. So I've been excited about having this book out. I wrote the first one well over a year ago, and it's, you know, half a thing you can't really talk about until the thing comes out. But also, I got it won a slot as a selection of the month for Amazon Prime Reads, which was just amazing to have that. Naturalist won that before in the past, and then getting this selected for that's great, which means a lot of people get the chance to see it. So if you're an Amazon Prime member, you can get this for free. It's going to be available at large on May 1st. And also what I like, though, too, is the audiobook pricing on this is pretty inexpensive, too, when that gets released, et cetera. Most of all, I love the story. It's about Sloan McPherson. She's a police diver in South Florida who comes from sort of a bit of a family with a little bit of a sketchy history there. And she finds herself immersed in a case that's bigger than herself, and she has to realize, what does she want to do with her life? Maybe she will go into law enforcement in a more serious capacity. It involves scuba diving. It involves drug cartels. It involves a lot of action adventure, and it was a lot of fun to write, and the sequel will be coming out next year. So The Girl Beneath the Sea, I hope you guys check it out, and I'm thrilled. If you've read it and you liked it, please go on Amazon and tell people something they'll like about it. And this is the way I feel about reviews, is that a review can do two things. Either I don't believe reviews should necessarily persuade, particularly when it comes to books, because there's a million books out there. You want people to find the book that they want. And I say, hey, tell people what you like about a book, because then people will go, oh, this is for me. Or they'll go like, oh, maybe another time or something different. So if you haven't read it, leave a review for somebody else's book too. I'm like, I can't tell you how much it helps authors or YouTube creators or podcasters. Reviews move so much of the world. We have so much unexercised power right now as consumers. We don't even think about it. You know, your ability to say something can have a really well-written review on a podcast page on YouTube or a comment on YouTube or on Amazon can be more persuasive than a mention in the New York Times. This is like a fact. So anyhow, The Girl Beneath the Sea, available now.
Boom, number one, baby.
Yay.
How many days in a row now?
6 days. If we hit tomorrow, it'll be a full week at the number one slot.
A week at the top. See what the world already knows.
By the way, I would imagine that if I were in your position, I would be obsessively hitting refresh on those reviews. As you round the corner to the statistically significant number, yeah, you're sitting at a fat and cozy 4.5 stars, my friend. Congratulations.
Yeah, I'll tell you the thing that happens, though, the more popular a book gets, the wider the audience for it. And then you come to people who are go like, oh, I'll give this category a try. And you see that sort of the little kind of flattening of that thing. And that's the thing you have to mentally prepare yourself for, because enjoy it.
I think we talked about this before, but on a Modern Rogue video or a Scam Nation video, I get a little bit antsy if the thumbs up to thumbs down ratio is over 99%, because that's code for we haven't burst out of our bubble. We haven't gotten out where everybody can actually see it. And so instead, like, there's actually, I kind of get excited when suddenly there's an uptick in downvotes, because it implies that it's being recommended to a lot more people.
Yeah, for sure. That's, you know, kind of the weird thing. And the thing, too, I've noticed, like, if you do a good, competent sequel, you'll watch your numbers go, your ratings go up. And I'm like, well, it's not like I became a better writer. It's just that if you finished the first book, you were on board with this. If you didn't like the first book, then you're not going to go to the second one.
Right.
So, you know, in an environment like that, where it's highly linear, moving from one to the other, you see that pattern. But I'm thrilled. People seem to like it. People seem to love Sloan. And couldn't be happier with what's happening with the book. Not the world in general. Make that very clear. With the book. No. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.